This series of Kicking It Off is sponsored by Bazooka Goals, Airpitch and 3v3 UK. Having been a coach for over three decades, I know how important it is to have equipment that's easy to use and immediately engages the players. Bazooka Goals is the award-winning pop-up goal that's the perfect partner for small-sided games and training. Remember, every dream starts with a goal. And if you want to take your games to the next level, Airpitch's unique system keeps the ball in play 95% of the time. And coaches, if you're like me and want to bring the best of football, futsal and street football together, then 3v3 UK hosts tournaments and festivals around the country, as well as having a great franchise program. It's all about fast feed fun. All three of these brands will help you create a fun-filled, vibrant environment in which to produce the happy, active, skillful players of the future.
Hello and welcome to Kicking It Off, the podcast series for those interested in sports, football and the coaching of young children. We have another brilliant guest joining us today, the one and only Mr. Dan Machichi. Dan was one of the first people we considered when we were planning for this podcast series because his career as a coach and as a manager is extensive and incredibly impressive. Now, as I'm sure you can imagine, Dan is a very busy man, so this conversation was recorded virtually in our online studio. So let's head over there now to hear all about Dan's journey, the things he's learned along the way, and any advice he wants to share with our fellow coaches. Welcome, Dan. Welcome to our little online studio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honour. Lovely to see you both.
And this is something that we like to ask most of our guests or a lot of our guests that we have on. So if you wouldn't mind telling us about your own journey to where you are now and how has your approach been shaped along the way? And if so, has there been anybody that has helped shape that with you?
Yeah. So basically, my coaching journey was shaped well before I actually took a coaching session. So really from my childhood. So my family are Italian. So growing up, I always watched Italian football and Spanish football through the 80s and sort of 90s. And I guess I got to watch the game in a very observant way with the peers that I had. I was around a lot of adults, a lot of football purists, and sort of grew to sort of love the game through that format, really. And then I had, I guess, another big influence on me was a cousin that I had who unfortunately was diagnosed with an illness, serious illness, when he was about 13. And he ended up being paralyzed from the neck down. And two things really that really shaped me was, one, how he showed that anything's possible in life, because he learned to paint with his mouth and he opened an art gallery with his mouth, with his paintings. Like I said, he learned to paint with his mouth, which was incredible to actually witness that. But then secondly, the carers that he had and how basically his parents reshaped their lives for him, and basically everything that they did was for him, as well as all the nurses and carers he had. So I guess in terms of my coaching, and I know it's not as, definitely not as serious and as dramatic as that, but what I try to do for players is really give them my all and kind of go above and beyond for them. And then, so that was really before I even took a coaching session. And I guess because my family were Italian or are Italian and they met in England, they couldn't really help me with things like my studying because they couldn't speak English brilliantly at the time. So I didn't really have that support at home. So I've always had to work really hard for anything. I was the one with the maths and English private tutor. I then managed to go to Loughborough University, and again, all my peers found sort of education a lot more natural than me, and managed to sort of sail through university and still go out five nights a week. Whereas I maybe only made three of those nights, but I was having to do triple the amount of work. So I guess going into my coaching, I probably had a work ethic about me, and I had an outlook on the game, but also on unconditional support.
Wow. I mean, I know we're hoping that lots and lots of coaches are listening to this, but I think some of what you've just said are lessons in life anyway, that, you know, sometimes we don't know what we're going to have to cope with, but helping in our domain, players become resilient and into the mindset that anything is possible. I think you've just given a brilliant example of how that applies to you. So that's a great start. So where did it go from there, Dan?
Yeah, so I guess I had a bit of a sliding doors moment, really, because I managed to get my first coaching role at Crystal Palace under somebody who obviously you both know really well, Paul Holder. And I got introduced to Paul from somebody at Loughborough. And I was actually driving past the university. I'd been up north. I just finished a master's. Wasn't really sure where I was, what I wanted to do or how I was going to get there. And I was just driving past Loughborough, and I decided to pull over and call one of my ex-coaches, James Ellis, who's now at Arsenal doing extremely well. And if he hadn't have answered his phone, I maybe would never have then got to Paul, but he answered the phone. I went in and saw him, and I mentioned this Palace job, and he knew Paul, and the rest was sort of history, really. And back in those days, this was in 2004, it was a bit more informal in terms of interview processes than maybe it is now. So it was more of a chat, and Paul just gave me a chance, really. And I was well out of my depth. But it was a really good learning curve for me in terms of kind of my first, I think I got into good coaching habits really early on, because there was a real environment there of thinking differently about how you work with young people. It was very player centered. And just to give you an example, the game was literally an extension of training, to the point where we would set the children challenges in games. No matter who the opponent was, they would have challenges in games where for a period in the game, they would play, say, four, these were like under 10s, four periods of 15 minutes. And for one period, they had to play in silence. And this would be on a match day. Or it might be specific children at a specific time who would be playing in silence. And then the next period, it might be a different challenge. It might be when we give a corner away, we need to keep four players up on the halfway line. And it was only eight aside. And I remember thinking, come on, this isn't what I've driven an hour and a half for. Because it was a bit of a journey for me. Literally, the small salary that I got for working there all went on my expenses. I was literally doing it for free. And I was thinking, come on, we've got Chelsea today. We've got Tottenham today. I'm meant to be the manager here. And now we're setting them all these challenges. But it was brilliant, because I felt really free to experiment. And I saw things work, you know. And always remember, I was working with this group for a couple of months. And I asked Paul could he take them for 10, 15 minutes? And he put them into a small area, and he was working on passing into fetal space. So he put four boxes in each of the corners of the rectangle, and they started playing. And I thought, there's no way they're going to be able to do this. I've been working with these children for a couple of months. This will be far too difficult for them. And what was really interesting about how Paul created the right environment for them was, before they even kicked the ball, he asked them to jog into a square. And it was a good lesson for me in terms of, sometimes we just assume they know what the playing area is and where the cones are and where they actually need to attack and defend. So he got them to jog into one square, then another, etc. So they knew what the environment was. And then they just started playing, and the ball was going out, and they were having no success at all. And all he kept saying to them was, unlucky, keep going. And I was thinking, this guy's mad. Like, what's he doing? And honestly, within a couple of minutes, all he was doing was he was waiting for somebody to do something well. And then he stopped it. That was the first time he stopped it. And he said, "That was brilliant, young man. Show everyone what you just did and why you did it." And he got the peer-to-peer learning out. And honestly, within about 2 or 3 minutes, it was too easy for them. He had to start setting them new challenges and make the area smaller. And it was a real eye-opener for me in terms of what they're capable of and how what we do can literally take them in one direction or another. And so that was a really good learning curve there. I worked with another special person, David Njai, who worked with the foundation phase, and he was a learning mentor in a school in Brixton. And he was brilliant for me in terms of child development and child psychology and being empathetic and understanding them as a person and how you speak to them as well, being very specific with your praise, not just so they understand what you mean, but also for the parents to hear what you're saying. And if you can praise them for things off the ball, the parents start to see the game in different ways. So there was lots of learning there at Palace for me before I then moved on to Tottenham.
And so that you've talked about different challenges that you'd set these groups of kids. Is that something that you took from Palace to Tottenham and everywhere else that you've worked at?
I guess at Tottenham, it was, again, I think a big thing for me across my coaching journey is being adaptable and not trying to take one thing and think that you're going to do it in the next environment you work in. What I try to do is understand what I've learned in that chapter of my journey and what pieces of the jigsaw I'm going to take to my next role, but knowing that there's other pieces of the jigsaw that need to be added. So I probably took to Tottenham an understanding of visual cues, the importance of visual cues with young people, how just, you know, if you want them to be compact, for example, putting some cones down the middle of the pitch, splitting the cones vertically, the pitch in vertically in thirds, safe zones, then taking safe zones away, those kinds of things I think I took there. But Tottenham was the next level, really, in terms of, I'd say, standards, because John McDermott and Chris Ramsey and Alex Inglethorpe, they were the sort of people that were working there. And they just arrived when I got my role there. And again, I was very fortunate because David, who I just mentioned at Palace, he knew Chris. So I got that introduction. And so I guess the importance of relationships and maybe creating a good impression with people can be helpful in your journey. And again, when I went to Tottenham, it was a very different environment to Palace. And I had to learn very quickly about not wasting a second in training. The coaching program was very different. It was a lot more unopposed work, but it was done in a way where it linked to a learning theme. And it was done in a way where the children were very expressive. And again, it was consistent with what you're asking to do on a match day. So, and you know, I just tried to watch as much as I could at that stage. I was going in on my nights off. I was just going in and I was a sponge, basically. Go and watch Chris, go and watch John and Alex. And there was other coaches there who were very, you know, talented as well. And kind of just tried to pick up as much as I could. I think they had a very good eye for young players, you know, particularly the late developers, players who you'd look at and think, oh, they're miles off it, or physically they're not there, but they were very patient, or they would be very creative how they would utilise them on a match day in certain positions, in certain systems. And I think that something that maybe doesn't get spoken about enough about that academy at the time was the caring approach they had. So if somebody had an injury, for example, and was going to hospital, even though the physio would or the doctor would go with the family on a Sunday afternoon to the hospital, often Chris or John would be there. And I know so many stories of young players who have said they've opened their eyes at midnight in the hospital bed and the first face they see is one of theirs. And I think that's something which isn't the norm it's very easy, and I'm talking about myself here, it's very easy just to say to a physio or doctor, I'll drop us a message, let me know how they are, or you drop a message to the family or a phone call. But actually being there and being there through the night, again, that holistic side of things was something which I probably, like I said, is understated there. So they had a really good balance between excellence and empathy and a real caring approach. But the bar was very high. The vision was to develop Champions League players. And ironically, 15 years later, 2019, I went to the Champions League final, Tottenham and Liverpool, because of another player that I worked with further along the line who invited me to the game. And I think there was three starters in the 11 from Tottenham's academy and two or three on the bench. So probably just shows that it takes time for a vision to come to fruition, but it can be done.
Yeah. Danny, this is fascinating because I knew some of your journey, but just looking at the layers underneath is really interesting. You've covered a lot. I'm hoping the listeners understand that already you've talked about the importance of the environment and about seeing them as people or young people rather than just footballers. I think that's an absolute gold dust for any coaches who are listening in about how to build those relationships and make those connections. But you've also spoken about structuring learning, about how you walk the players through what you might, the demands of the session, how session design is really important, about repeating a practice, but knowing that the players were probably just learning about how to be successful in the practice the first 20 minutes and sticking with it or going back to it, knowing that the players are going to come in at a different level of understanding.
Yes.
All of this applies to coaches at all levels. So it's fascinating that you've been through that and how it's developed you as a result of going through that process.
Thank you. And then I made quite quite an unusual decision, really, because things were going well at Tottenham. And again, through David, he's not my agent, by the way, but, you know, we've stayed in touch ever since. And he knew Mike Dove at MK Dons, and the club was a year old and they were looking for somebody to sort of put the programme together. So I managed to get some good advice from different people that I trusted. Whereas I think if I'd have made that decision on my own, I would have just stayed at Tottenham. You know, we had the facilities, we had the players, we had trips abroad. I remember actually just before I left, Pete, there was a session at Wembley Stadium with the Tottenham at different age groups, which we worked together on actually with one of the groups, if you recall. So you were giving up all of that. And I was literally going into an academy which, on my first day, I was expecting to have all my kit ready for me in a pile, and there was nothing. And I did my first session in my own clothes. and the first season there, I didn't have a bench coat. So they never gave me a coat. So I used to wear my, I did like my next coat, but I didn't expect to have to wear it to work. But what it taught me was the importance of improvisation. Because literally, resources-wise, human and physical resources, and you'll know from having come in a few times, Pete, we were right at the bottom of anywhere. We had five pitches, council-owned. The groundsman wasn't allowed on them. They had holes in them when it got hot. So I used to beg one of the parents to bring sand to the training ground, and we'd fill the holes with sand. We'd have to put the nets up. I mean, I think they've still got my fork from my garden, because I remember in one of the games, there was puddles everywhere. I had to take my fork to the pitch and fork the 6-yard box. And so you had all those things, and you're still trying to drive a program of excellence. And what they did have was they had some really top high potential young players who, and I guess the challenge was keeping them there. And at the time, they were a little bit sort of the whipping boys. They weren't mind me saying that. I remember when I was at Tottenham and we'd played MK Dons, you know, you were talking well into double figures. And, you know, if you want to retain players, you know, this is the other side of development. You know, you need to at least compete. I'm not saying you win, but if you can keep so I think sometimes coaches think winning keeps players happy or keeps parents happy. But what I learned was, as long as the games were competitive and within a goal or two, but you played in the right way and they were getting a lot of game time and they were enjoying the environment, they'll stay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we never lost any of them. And I remember we went to Tottenham within a couple of months of me being at MK Dons and we actually won the game by a goal. And I would have been comfortable with us not. But what I just tried to do was raise the bar with them, raise their belief. And I remember they came in from one of the periods. I think there were a couple of goals down and they were really happy. And I just tried to drive them in terms of, no, you're capable of them more than this. And so sometimes I think they just need a bit of encouragement and a bit of, oh, I can do this. Again, going back to my childhood. So, yeah, it was a great experience in terms of writing a program, a lot of trial and error, a lot of having critical friends. Paul was my critical friend there in terms of program design. He came in a lot, like yourself, Pete, like John Allpress, you know, the people who I regard as the real experts in this field. And, you know, the academy manager gave me a lot of freedom. He never once in 7.5 years asked me about a result, not once. And so he really created an environment for staff that, you know, we could be ourselves. And as long as we put the individual first and we played in a particular way, he was happy with that.
Yeah.
And and he actually role modelled that with the under 18s as well. They'd often finish bottom of the league, but they'd get two or three players into the first team. So, yes. But I think as well, what the environment did was it made people well-rounded. It made myself develop, you know, a lot of humility, because you had to be, you can't work in those environments with an entitled approach, because you are going to have to drive a minibus and you are going to have to really think differently. So when I talk about improvisation, we had a very small dome. It must have been 60 by 40. But you'd often have two or three age groups in on one night. So, you know, we'd have to think differently. We'd get local schools who we'd do different agreements with them. We wouldn't be able to pay them, but, you know, we'd find other ways, tickets or CPD for them, whatever it was. And we'd use their sports hall for futsal evening. So one group would go in there and do futsal. The other group would be in the dome and they'd be playing a match against a local team, because we didn't have any scouts, you see. We had one, but he was a part-time scout. He did a really good job, a guy called Ian, but he worked for a printers. And, you know, he just did the best he could. So, again, we had to think differently about how to get players in. So by playing local grassroots teams, one, we'd build a relationship with them. And two, you know, we'd use it for scouting. So we would always play a year younger against them, or maybe two. We wouldn't be fussed about whether they beat us or not. But by playing a younger team against them, it would actually make the game a lot more competitive, because it wasn't about us winning 10-0. It was about challenging our boys. We might play with a player or two less. And it was about, can they give their individuals an opportunity to shine?
Yeah. Just as an aside, and we are trying to change the landscape through, particularly for player development, through these podcasts. I remember you were so creative with pitch sizes or numbers on each team on different size pitches. Can you just give us a little bit more information about that? Just because it might convince other coaches to be as creative with what they've got, but also to present their players with a lot more variety of opportunity.
And I think it's also really nice to hear that your experiences, your whole journey has been at some points the more glamorous side of what coaching can be, and then also some really humble environments, and that actually you might not have the funding or the resources to be offering these children lots of this new equipment, this new this, this, that, but that actually if the attitude that the whole staff team have, all of that trickles down to what you see on the pitch. So it was just really nice here, because hopefully for a lot of our grassroots coaches, well, not hopefully, that will probably be the case for a lot of our grassroots coaches, that the resources that they have are going to be on the lesser side. So it's really, it would be great to hear about your philosophy of player development and how you became so creative, possibly not being able to have a lot to hand.
Yes, no problem. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the pitch sizes, I'm sure there'll be coaches listening to this who could relate to this. So if you've ever had a group of players who you think are technically able and are losing heavily in matches, it might actually be because of the field size. And that was what I encountered. So I'd watch them in training thinking they're really good in tight areas and they play around the corners and they drop a shoulder and they can take somebody on. And then he got to like two or three matches in and it was like 10-1, 11-1, 12-1. But when I looked at the goals that were being conceded, they were literally, you know, long balls in behind and foot races. So again, this goes back to giving a lot of praise to the academy manager, because I suggested to him about playing on a smaller pitch. And where we tried to be very fair with the opposition was, I remember the first time we did it against, you know, a Premier League club and Cat One. Well, they were a Cat One club today. I won't mention the name, but we had a full size pitch, and then I put cones out. Got there early, put cones out onto that pitch into a 60x40, and that 60x40 wasn't done on any research. You know, it was. You know, I got accused of being anecdotal at the time with a lot of the methods. But, you know, I didn't have time to start collecting stats. I didn't have analysts who could collect this data for me. It was literally, a lot of it was on speaking to the players, watching football, and just judging the distances, really. A bit of trial and error, really. So made a 60x40, wheeled onto the pitch, smaller goals. And basically, when this opposition arrived, just said to them, look, we're going to play on a 60x40 for the first two periods. If after the two periods you don't like it, we'll take the cones away and the goals off the pitch, and then we'll go full size. That's okay. They said, yeah, that's fine. So anyway, after the two periods, they were actually winning the game 5-2. And their kids were much better than ours at adjusting to those areas.
Yeah.
And I remember two or three of ours came in crying, and you know, they were asking for the cones to be taken off. And anyway, I looked at their staff after the second period and I said, are you happy with the pitch? And they said, yeah, it's brilliant. So I said, okay. So I said to ours, we're going to stay with this pitch. And we just talked through what are the things you're going to have to do on this pitch size to have success. So we talked about 1-2s and third man runs, etc. Different combinations. And anyway, they came back and won the game 7-5. And basically, at the end of the game, I always remember there was a Football League inspector there. And he came over to me and said he's going to report us because the goals were too small. And I said to him, well, the goals were small, but there was 12 goals in the game. So they couldn't have been that small. And the next day, that club reported us as well, even though after the second period, they said it was fine.
Yeah.
So we knew after that first experiment, if you like, that we were onto something. So we had, like I said, we had five pitches. So we just did one pitch, 50x30, then 60x40, 70x50, 80x60, and then full size. And we had offside lines in the thirds as a guideline for the players in terms of pitch geography, but also for offsides in the thirds. Because what we found was if it was on the halfway line, it would encourage long ball football rather than playing through the thirds. So that's how we went about it. And ironically, we had some of our groups So I think about one of the boys who's playing who played a couple of nights ago in the Euros, Kevin Danso, played against France for Austria. His age group were a very athletic group and they disliked it the most. Because what would happen is they would play away from home and they would comfortably beat anyone they played against. Doesn't matter who it was. But it was a lot of like counter-attacking speed. And that's fine because that's part of the game as well. So basically what I learned was it's not about playing on a small pitch every week. It's about variety. So we challenged them. We challenged all of them, but their challenge was, right, when you go away from home, you're having a lot of success. But can you do it at home on a smaller pitch?
Yeah.
And they actually struggled, not just for one or two games, I would say for a couple of years. Wow. And then it was kind of by the time they were under 15s where I could just leave them on a match day. And I just knew they could play away from pressure. They could play through the lines. They could protect the ball. They could roll out of trouble. And I would sometimes, I might be taking the group and just turn up in the second period or just leave them to it. And, you know, you had in that group the likes of Brandon Thomas Asante, who's at West Brom now, Sam Nombe, who played in the Championship last year, Callum Britton, who's at Blackburn. You know, a lot of them have gone on and done extremely well. And even though a lot of it was collaborative with the players and parents, we'd always ask them for their views and how they were feeling. Sometimes you've got to go as well with, you know, this is going to be tough. You know, to be a footballer, it is tough and you've got to be adaptable. But we'd like to think as well, there's a small part of this that we kind of have got an idea of what you need as well. Yeah. And we want you to go with this.
Wow.
If you include smaller format games in your sessions, then check out Bazooka Goals, Air Pitch and 3v3 UK to support the development of you and your players.
So that notion of variety and really different challenges. There's this phrase, isn't there? If the challenge is high, the support has to be high. But eventually you want the challenge to be high and you can almost separate yourself from it so that the players can sort it out themselves. And this notion of giving players not just the opportunity, but almost encouraging them to be more resilient, to be more responsible on the pitch, repositions the coach because they're not relying on you for all of the information, but you must be quite secure that they're going to be able to cope with it because of everything that you've taken them through leading up to that point.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that I learned early on, actually, from speaking to the boys, because we used to play two games a week. So I actually think our ratio of games to training and games overall compared to other clubs was a lot higher. So Kevin alone, I remember one season, he played 75 games.
Wow.
And I remember him playing two games in one day, which, you know, would never happen today. And I'm not saying it was the right thing, but it was what happened. And he could cope with it, you know, and a lot of it again was conversation, you know, how are you feeling? Do you think you can play again today, etc.? And you build that trust as much as you can rather than just going on that, you know, objective measures. I think you need a balance between the two. So what I learned was if we played on a Sunday, the boys actually liked being able to try some things out on the Saturday or Sunday and then quickly having another opportunity, not having to wait another week. Yeah. And we didn't have big numbers, so we often didn't have any subs, or we often would go to a game with maybe one less. I remember whenever we played like the likes of Norwich or Ipswich, we'd always go with at most 11. We wouldn't take a sub. Sometimes we'd take 10. And but say we took 11, we knew that if we got an injury, we could just get somebody from another pitch and then they would be playing 2 years up. So, but what it did was our boys, they were playing all the time. They were playing fatigued. And then, like I said, they were getting another go quite quickly after. So if something didn't quite work, then like I said, within 48 hours, they were trying it again in a realistic situation against maybe a local team that was 2, 3, 4 years older than them. Yeah. And they'd get that different challenge. And I just felt at the time, and you know, the coaches really bought into it, was it was a lot more format improvisation. We couldn't train as much as Cat 1 clubs because we were in the Cat 1 Games program, because it wasn't ECCC then. So we couldn't train as often as those clubs. We couldn't go on the tours they went on. We didn't have the coach to player ratios. So we had to do something different in order to accelerate the learning. Yeah. So things like, you know, I've probably, the minibus was like my second home, or my first home, my wife would say, because I was literally in it all the time. You know, whoever would play us, we'd play. We'd never turn down a game, because we just wanted to build that culture that if clubs, or it might be a county FA, if a county FA under 18s needed a game, they knew they could ask us and we would say yes.
I think something that's really nice is that you've talked about you were required a certain level of improvisation from the coaching staff, but then in these challenges that you presented to these players, they were also required to be improvising and to be problem solving on the spot. And I think when, especially for young children, when they can see that their teachers, the people that they're learning from, the people that they're growing from or are expecting them to grow, are also thinking on their feet and are also going through that those processes, I think it's really nice for that to be mirrored, that coaches don't have the attitude of, we know everything, nothing's going to change, and our how we approach something is really fixed. Yeah. When you're expecting the children to do really flexible thinking, that actually it's a two-way street. And it's been really nice when you've touched on, you've always had an open dialogue with your players. How are you feeling? Checking in. Because especially when we're working with such young players, I think that's really important for them. It's been really nice in other conversations that we've had that you're giving and you're allowing your young players to have a voice,
yeah,
and to do that critical thinking for themselves and to do that empathetic thinking and supportive thinking for themselves and for their teammates. Because hopefully that's going to produce not just great players, if we're obviously focusing on football, but just good people in general, whatever they go on to do. So it's been really nice that your approach at all of the different clubs that you've been at has kept those things been a constant. Because I think in all the conversations and all the chats we're having, we're learning that they are things that just can't, that just...
They're non-negotiables.
Yeah. They just need to be in there. And so we know that when you were national coach, you obviously created this environment and your players were playing in a really, really creative way. And so how did that come about? And were there any key messages, I suppose, that you were asking or requiring of your players?
I mean, where did it come from? I guess it's a number of things. One, like I mentioned before, about my childhood growing up. Again, my mum's from Naples, so in the 80s, Diego Maradona was at Napoli. So I used to get all of his video cassettes sent to me from my cousins in Italy, because we didn't have Sky back then. And we didn't have the access like we do today. And I think that's sometimes things which we need to remember, that how throughout all of this, you're having to adapt as well as a human being to changes in technology, changes to the game, rule changes, etc.
Dan, video cassette?
Pardon?
What's a video cassette?
Tell me about it. Exactly. It's true, isn't it? You know, so, you know, it was very different landscape to what it is today. And, I think my childhood, in terms of the type of players I was watching, the types of football, not just attacking football, but defensively as well, the art of defending. Again, the Italians have probably been renowned for that over the years, not using physicality to win duels, you know, positioning, timing, etc. And then I guess those three roles that I had up until going to the FA, in all those three clubs that I was fortunate to work at, we played in a I mean, Tottenham was, the football philosophy was around total football. So you played in a shape, not a position. And they were very strong on that. So if you were a centre-back, for example, they would encourage you to step into midfield. They'd expect a midfielder to then drop into the back line. And then they wouldn't swap necessarily straight away. They would, it might be another 2 or 3 minutes until the ball goes out or what have you. And then at MK Dons, we probably took it to other levels. We had to, because who we were competing against, if we didn't play differently or in a creative way, then because we didn't really have, we couldn't compete either on an athletic level. Other clubs had much more athletic players than us at the time. So we had to play in a way where we could overcome that. We had to maybe outthink them. And just before I left, because what led to me going to the FA was we used to have stadium games, because that was a strategy to get the chairman and the first team manager to see the young players, because they're not going to come to the... I mean, in all fairness to Carl Robinson, he tried his best to come to Saturday morning games, but it wasn't a regular thing because of what his role was. So stadium games allowed him, the chairman, etc., the key stakeholders, to watch these boys play. But also the challenge of, we would get around 3,000-4,000 coming to these games, because what we'd do was we'd set a challenge to all the players in the academy that whoever sold the most amount of tickets would get to spend a day with the first team. And so it got quite competitive. There'd be some selling 130, 140 odd tickets. So anyway, we did these games, and I remember the first time we did it, and Trevor Brooking and Gareth Southgate would come to watch. Gareth was working in grassroots at the time at the FA around match format. So we started to strike a relationship, but Trevor started to get intrigued in what we were doing, and we started to get call-ups into the England squads. I think when I left, we had 11 in the England pathway.
Wow.
And those stadium games sort of flipped, because by the end, I remember my last 2 months at the club, we had 9 invites from other clubs. And often it was, you present us with a different challenge. The academy manager got a little bit paranoid because he thought that it was because they were trying to take our players. And I had to reassure him, look, this is what they're telling me. But on top of that, good. You know, would you rather they thought our players were good than not good? And it's up to us to create the right environment that will make them want to stay. So anyway, I went to the FA quite, I guess at the time I was very risk averse when it came to coaching and my beliefs. I had a lot of confidence in what I thought was possible on the pitch by now. And my expectations of these players were through the roof. And so it wasn't a difficult transition from a coaching point of view, because they were far more capable than anyone I'd ever worked with. What was the challenge for me was the social corner, because I was used to working, seeing boys every day or most days, knowing the families, knowing their personalities, to now you'd see them for a week and then you wouldn't see them for 3 months. So I had a lot of different challenges at the FA. One was the social corner. Two was on the planning side of things, the technological side of things. So I would say going to the FA was a sort of a period of, if I had to evolve quickly, because things needed to be recorded a lot more. They weren't our players. So from a people's perspective, dealing with key stakeholders, etc., was massive. But the playing style side wasn't something that I found too difficult, to be honest. And it was, we just do it again. Probably the biggest challenge in terms of the playing style was getting the players to believe. So I remember regularly doing exercises with them around pick your world 11. And there was a reason for this. So this was done with, you know, the likes of Mark Guey and Phil, who obviously played yesterday, Phil Foden. So they would have done this exercise. So I knew when they would do this exercise, they might pick one English player, but more often than not, they wouldn't. So it was pick your world 11, we'd ask them to put themselves in their teams. They'd do it in maybe groups of two or three. So they'd have eight plus the three of them, because it would give them, I wanted them to visualize themselves in a world leading team. Then we'd ask them to put a description of why they've picked those players. So what were the attributes? We'd even let them pick a subs bench. And when they put the sheets on the floor, there was barely an English player. And if they was, their reason for picking them was around sort of leadership and aggression, which, of course, they're still important attributes to have. But what wasn't coming through was that they weren't associating English players with the other side of the game. So the challenge was set to them in 10 years' time when this exercise, so it'd be now. If the staff at the FA were doing that exercise tomorrow with the under 15, 16, 17s, would there be anyone in there? And you'd probably argue there would be. And that's credit to many people, and more so the players themselves.
And you mentioned it with Tottenham and players playing in the Champions League, that these things take time. And so I think it's really nice when we can hammer in that point for grassroots coaches or anyone, coaches or family, anyone working with young children, that you're not gonna reap the benefits of the things that you're doing immediately. It could be a decade, it could be two decades before you're seeing it, but that there's so much evidence behind to support why it is still worth doing and why it is still so important. Because yeah, I would definitely, I'm not a footballer myself, but if I was in this dream world where I'm somehow playing for the women's first team under 15, 16s, and I was asked to do that challenge, I would definitely, there would be English players that I would pick now from the women's and from the men's team. Yeah. But that's not happened overnight. That's taken a really, really long time.
I think one of the phrases that people use is, are you coaching for the result on Saturday or are you coaching for the next 10 years? And I think from what you've said, Dan, you've always had one eye on the future and been willing to give players time if they need it. And I know personally, I always look at, a bit like yourself, what is the potential for these players and how high can we really set the bar? And I think too often, because the result tends to mess with our thinking, we always set the bar too low in order to try to get a result. And yet if we work the other way around, it might take us a little bit longer, but we're going to get exactly what we want eventually.
So with that, have you got any golden nuggets of advice that you might offer to a grassroots coach that would be useful for them to take forward in their coaching journey, with that thinking of, let's know we can afford to set our standards a little higher and to have higher expectations? Have you got any words of wisdom that you'd like to share?
I think when you set objectives, it's really important that you also have the how you're going to do it and how you're going to measure it. And it doesn't have to be anything complicated. But I find it really useful even now, having like a purpose on a page. So it doesn't have to be a big document, but what is it you're trying to achieve and how are you going to do it? And then try and stick to that plan. And as they say, you write a philosophy with a pencil, not with ink, because it can constantly change and evolve. But from my experience, by having that framework, and again, you can do those exercises with the players, once you've got that buy-in and everybody's clear on where you're trying to go, you've always got a framework to work off. So ours became off the back of those exercises, to inspire the next generation of players. It was something like that. Yeah. And then we had like, how are we going to do it? So we wanted to dominate every game, no matter who the opposition was. We wanted to show humility at all times. So how we do that, I'll give you an example. We went to Florida for a tournament against, I'd been the year before and we were miles off it in all areas. And that's not a criticism of anybody, any staff, any players, but we were miles off it. I remember we played Brazil. It was about 35 degrees heat. We were there an hour and a half early. We were outside warming up for 45 minutes. The players came off sweating buckets. Brazil weren't there. I thought we were in the wrong place. And then literally 10 minutes before the game started, this coach pulled up outside the stadium. They were in their kit with their boots on, and they just did some fast feet with a ball between two just to the side of the pitch, and then walked onto the pitch, and we couldn't get the ball off them. And it was a real, it was a nice early sort of lesson in terms of think again, going back to the think differently, and a lot of sort of common sense as well. And we played Portugal, and I remember we beat Portugal, but it was a bit of a sort of smash and grab. And so anyway, we went the year after, and Rio Ferdinand did a really inspirational talk to the boys beforehand. So we tried to tee it up early. So the importance of utilising a different voice, not thinking as a coach that your voice is always the one that matters. If you can get other people, park your ego, and it's for the boys, and they're going to take some really strong messages of someone like him more than they will from me. And they got some really good learning out of that. And we actually used it throughout the trip in terms of what would Rio say? And that became our phrase. What would Rio say now? Anytime something sort of felt like it was going to become tough. But what would Rio say now? So we found like, I guess, something memorable for them to latch onto. But then in Florida, everybody got 50% game time. And regardless of the fact that Dan Ashworth had said to me, you know, try and win that one. And it kind of, the program was built around win when it matters. So we knew the events that we'd have where we're experimenting, we're trying things, we're going to leave them to it, to others where, right, we're going to try and win this, but still within with the same culture and beliefs. And Stephen Sessegnon was the only one who didn't get that game time because he did his ACL after 50 seconds on his debut. But again, that led to the boys rallying around him, carrying his crutches for him, looking after him. So it developed, it helped develop them as people, just that one instance. And Stephen, in terms of his resilience, and his twin brother was there, Ryan. So it became, we called it family first. Like, we really built a family feel around that trip. So then Mark Gooey, ironically, ended up playing every minute of every game because of Stephen's injury. But going back to what I said, I had to learn before around key stakeholders, that was with liaising with his club, Chelsea, who were brilliant, and knowing the player, he could do it. So we won the first game, and then we've gone to pit the team for the second game, and it's against Brazil. And I remember sitting with the coaches, and we'd said before the camp what we were going to do, 50% game time. And then we won the first game and we were excellent. Our football was, I mean, one of our goals, we won in the last kick of the game, Jadon Sancho. And it was a really good point for the boys because they didn't rush into scoring that goal. We made 11 passes before we scored. One of our other goals was 25 pass move. So we were getting somewhere. And then, and you could feel it. And then the next morning, the coaches said, it's going to be difficult to make changes, isn't it? And I remember Paul Williams was with me. He was a great support and a good friend now. And we both looked at each other and went, why would it be difficult? We said what we were going to do. And other people were like, yeah, but this one played well and that one played well. And we said, no. We said we're going to make changes. So we're going to give them all an opportunity. So Jadon came out of the team and so another one came out of the team. And Mark stayed in the team because I think it was a squad of 18. So it wasn't the whole team change, but everyone who didn't start was now starting. And look, it was the likes of Emile Smith-Rowe, for example, Oliver Skip. You know, so we're talking ones who have got talent. And just because they haven't played in the first game, and the Brazil performance is probably in my coaching career the best performance I've ever been associated with because of the context. Going back to the Brazil example the year before, 12 months later, we had 65% possession, 94% pass completion. We won the game 2-0 with two incredible goals, and the game management was excellent. I remember coming back and we ironically we won the tournament, and Ryan, Stephen's twin, scored the goal in the last kick of the game to win the tournament. So it was kind of a lot of destiny within that trip as well. Football's not always like that, as we know. And then our flight got delayed by 24 hours. So it wasn't a completely perfect trip, but we didn't mind being in Florida for another day. But in terms of, and what had happened with that game, actually, because there's another story to that tour, is, if you don't mind me sharing it, is we played Holland. And in our the previous tournament we'd played in, we had, I remember we played Holland. Holland were in our hotel. And for the first few days, they didn't really acknowledge us or speak to us, maybe because they were going to play us. So anyway, we played them and we were incredible in that game. Again, 72% possession, two amazing goals. And we drew 2-2. And they scored with the last kick of the game. And the boys were devastated. And I remember their coach asking to speak to me and Richard Allen after the game. And he said it was the best performance he'd seen in 18 years in international football. And you know, we took that, you know, he's far more experienced than me. So, again, I use that with the boys, you know, in the next video, because I think any time you can sell them messages, particularly when they're feeling low, use the power of messaging from other people. So then in Florida, it was us against Holland to win the tournament, and we needed a draw. They needed to win, and we were 2-0 down. And then Ryan scored in the last kick of the game to win the tournament. And when we came back, Dan and Matt Crocker went public saying, you know, that was the England DNA, etc. So it was a bit of a sort of breakthrough moment, really. And, you know, I'd always be grateful to those players and staff for that.
And I think whilst we've just had some tournament talk, obviously we're recording this now as the Euros are going on. Yesterday was, not even sure I really want to talk about yesterday's
I
game
can't.
With Denmark. Yeah. But it's okay, because these podcasts will be released after the Euros, which we will have won, obviously. That's the, you know, that's what we've got to think. But this has been such an amazing chat, Dan, and it's so nice to hear players and names that we recognise and all of this work that you've done and this legacy. And your coaching and managing career is nowhere near finished, but the legacy that you've had already, the we're seeing now in first teams, is just testament to the things that we hope this podcast is, the messages that we are trying to send in this podcast, that it's the long game. It really is the long game. And if you're fortunate enough to work with young children, whatever the age, whether that is play phase, foundation phase, and then taking them through to ages 15, 16, when they're becoming young men and women, that you're with them for such a magical and creative period, that being a coach is a real honour. And yeah. So it's been really amazing to get to chat with you today, to hear about your journey and the great things that you've implemented along the way.
Yeah. Dan, I think we're only halfway through. We're going to have to do part two. I know you're a very busy man, but there's another part of your journey that we haven't really covered yet. But it's been brilliant chatting with you today. And you know, I know there's lots of things for coaches to listen to and hopefully be influenced by that will shape their journeys and their outlook and their philosophies, just as you've really clearly described, you know, what happened to you. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. And we'll definitely, series two, we'll get you back. Part two, Dan Machici.
I look forward to it.
Dan, that was brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Bazooka Goals, Airpitch and 3v3 UK, for helping us to create the perfect environment to develop happy, active and skillful players.